it will run, we'll take a break in December to talk about Jesus' incarnation and Advent, and we're going to also come back to our theme of prayer periodically. So it's going to take us until late winter, early spring to finish the Sermon on the Mount. But I think it's going to have a lot of great things for us. Now, so how many of you have ever heard of the Sermon on the Mount? Right, almost everybody in the world has heard of it. How many of you have read the Sermon on the Mount? So what's the main, what would you encapsulate the main idea in the Sermon on the Mount to be? Like, is it, here's how you should live, here's a good ethical system, pick it up and go for it, right? Is it, I think the Sermon on the Mount is actually very perplexing in what to do with it, in terms of what it actually is. And how we even enter it. And we're starting the Beatitudes this morning. The Beatitudes, in some ways, are just confusing and weird. And so I actually want to kind of deconstruct the Sermon on the Mount a little bit first and then reconstruct it. So I want to talk about the problem of the Sermon on the Mount, then solving the problem, and then living the solution. So the problem of the Sermon on the Mount, solving that problem, and then living the solution. So let me read it for us. And then pray and we'll dive in. Jesus says, seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. And a few verses later he says, for I tell you that unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Father, would you help us with your spirit this morning as we grapple with the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount and the whole concept of what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount. Would you be in our midst to give us eyes that see what you want to see and ears to hear what you are saying to us. Help us to understand it, but help us not let that understanding not stop with an intellectual understanding, but grip our hearts, call us to follow you, call us to know you and depend upon you for all things. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. So let's just talk a little bit first about the sermon, the whole Sermon on the Mount. If you look it up, there's 50 imperatives in the Sermon on the Mount. So there's a lot of things that's saying, do this, do this, do this. Like, let your light shine is an imperative. It says, be reconciled to your brother. Give to those who ask. Love your enemies. Pray in secret. Do not store up treasure in heaven. So those are just a few examples. There's 50 imperatives that Jesus gives of how to live. So kids, it's almost like you're in school and your main teacher isn't there. And a substitute teacher shows up. And this substitute teacher's name is Mr. Law. And all he's got is commands and laws and rules for you. He's like, do this. Okay, sit quietly in class. Sharpen your pencils. Do this, do this, do this. And no gum chewing. And says, Billy, you're chewing gum. Go to the principal. And then, Sally, I saw that smirk. Give me 20 push-ups. And Sally says, girl push-ups or boy push-ups? And he says, don't talk back. Make it 30 push-ups. Right? Mr. Law just gives you all kinds of rules and commands, and you got to just follow them. Right? So, is that what the Sermon on the Mount's about? It's just all these rules and laws that you better follow them or else. That's one way you could see it. Or another thing that's going on in the Sermon on the Mount is there's this intensification of the Old Testament laws. Right? So the Old Testament says, you shall not murder. Right? Okay, fine. But then Jesus says, you shall not become angry. And you're like, whoa, wait a minute now. Now you're getting serious and you're infringing on me. It says, the Old Testament says, do not commit adultery. But Jesus says, do not lust in your heart. Right? There's this radical intensification, this idealism of how we should live, that you're like, this is impossible. So you're back in school, your regular teacher's not there, and in comes another substitute. This is Miss Ideal, right? She's like, hey, everybody, class, this is wonderful. The sun is out. The birds are chirping. There's a cool breeze. This is just a great day for just to live perfectly. Let's just live. Let's learn perfectly and live perfectly, and everything's going to be great. Oh, look, some ants came in because someone didn't take the apple out. Oh, let's pick up each individual ant and give it a new home and a little bit of food outside. You're like, lady, you are completely out of touch with reality. Like, nobody can live like this, right? What you're presenting is you're so out of touch. I don't even know what to do with you. Right? So is that what the Sermon on the Mount's doing? It's giving us this idealism of live. I mean, at one point Jesus says, so be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. I talk about idealism. What do I do with that? But then it gets worse. There's this theme of two ways in the Sermon on the Mount. At the very end it says, you either can build your house on sand or on rock. And if you build your house on the sand, it will collapse with a great fall. If you build your house on the rock, it'll stand. And then it says later, and that two ways goes through all the whole thing, right? Jesus says, you can pray badly or pray well. You can give alms really poorly or really great. You can fast in a terrible way or in a good way. And you're like, and so you see this multiplied. There's only two ways. And you're like, could you please make it five ways? Because I don't like this one or two. Like, I don't think I can make the good way. That means I'm going to fall in the bad way. So could you please, how about like there's a sort of good way? No, there's not. There's just two. You either go one way or the other. So kids, it's almost like, continue the image, it's like your teacher's out and Willy Wonka comes in to teach your class. Right? And what does Willy Wonka say? He's like, you better choose right. Right? You're going to be brought to this decision. You either go right or go left. If you go if you choose wrongly, you're going to fall into the gobstopper machine and you're going to be drowned in 45% milk chocolate and chopped up and put into wrappers. Or if you choose rightly, you can inherit the whole factory. Right? It's dire. It's all or nothing, right? Between the two ways. And so there's great things if you pick the wrong way, but what if you pick the wrong, it's great if you pick the right way. What if you pick the wrong way? It's actually scary because three times Jesus mentions Gehenna, which was the flaming garbage pit outside of Jerusalem. So our translation calls it hell. The Greek word is Gehenna. It's this, throw your trash out there and it's always on fire. If you make the wrong decision, in one case he says, wide is the gate to destruction. So there's destruction and it's easy to find yourself there. It's easy to not find forgiveness. It's easy for God to say, depart from me. It's easy for your house to fall if you build it on the sand. So the Sermon on the Mount is not a nice, neat, ethical system to go to class and pick it up and say, I'm going to live my life by the Sermon on the Mount. Everything will be lovely. No, it's just, it's not set up like that. If you try to do that, that's ridiculous. Because it isn't just a nice, good, ethical code for how to live. It's, if you see that as, I'll just go, I think I'm doing pretty good overall. I just need some ethical system to deal with life. So let me, the Sermon on the Mount, I'll go to the Sermon on the Mount class and I'll just pick up some of the ideas there. Between all the laws, between the intensification down to the heart level of even, I'm angry with someone. I've violated the law. Down to the, I've got to decide right or left, and if I choose wrong, it's all over. It's not an ethical system. And then, if we even look at the Beatitudes, it's just odd and strange, right? Nine times, blessed are, and it gives you something. So blessed means happy. You're like, I didn't think religion was supposed to make me happy. I thought it was supposed to make me unhappy. What's he talking about happiness for? And then what's he talking, and then verse 4, blessed are those who mourn. Wait a minute, happy and fortunate are those who mourn? That's not how I think of happiness and fortunate people. So the whole thing is really confusing and odd. It's, the whole thing in the sense is, in our culture, we say, blessed are the rich, blessed are the arrogant, blessed are the self-contented, blessed are the sophisticated, right? But this list is completely the opposite. So there's a problem here, and I think if we try to just pick it up as, this is, kids, listen and do what the Sermon on the Mount says, and you'll be fine. You're going off to college, so just do what the Sermon on the Mount says. It'll keep you straight. No, that's not what this is, right? So what is it then? So that's the problem of what to do with it. How do we solve the problem? So actually, the way we solve the problem is we mourn. Verse 4. We solve the problem by realizing that we're poor. Verse 3. We solve the problem by being intentionally meek, verse 5, we solve the problem by hungering and thirsting for righteousness. So if you went up to one of those three substitute teachers and you said, I don't understand, I can't follow your system, could I follow you? Could I go home with you? Could you teach me how to do what you're telling me to do? They would be like, no, you can't. My job is only to come here and to give you laws or give you idealism or say, warn you, you're going to pick right or left and you better pick right. So they're not interested. They're doing school. They're not interested in helping you. So what the Sermon on the Mount is really, it's not school. It's not a spiritual, educational ethical system. It's really something more like a spiritual orphanage. We need to realize I can't live up to the laws, I can't live up to the idealism, I can't even choose right every single time. I'm like an orphan. I need an orphanage for someone to take care of me, to welcome me in, I need to belong to someone, because in the midst of all this I don't know what to do with it. And so the Beatitudes actually I think is the entry point into following someone to understand everything else. So without the Beatitudes, actually, we can't understand the rest of the Sermon on the Mount at all. And so to understand the Beatitudes, let's try to begin to get into them. So Jesus sees the crowds. He goes away from the crowds up onto this mountain. He sits down like a teacher would sit down, and his disciples come to him. Now, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, it says the crowds had listened to him and were amazed at him. So the crowds are there. Crowds are sort of like the people that are a little bit interested. But he's really speaking to his disciples. He's calling them to follow him. He's calling not just to learn, but he's calling them to follow him as a disciple, to be his disciples. And the path into being a disciple of Jesus is these first three kind of are all of a common category, is to be poor in spirit, to mourn, to be meek. And so we don't really like to be poor, right? We think of ourselves as middle class or upper middle class. But Jesus is saying, if you come to me and you're like, be middle class in spirit, there's nothing for you. Right? Because you're just going to want to add me on as a little piece to the rest of your life. You need to come, bless the people that are fortunate in God's eyes. The people that are going to be happy and well-to-do are those who come who are poor in spirit, who realize, I don't have anything to give to you, God, spiritually speaking, and I'm going to need you to give me everything because I'm poor. But Jesus says to them, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So they right now are welcomed into the kingdom of heaven. And then verse 4, blessed are those who mourn. So we don't think of anyone who's mourning as fortunate, right? We think of people who are self-contented are fortunate. But Jesus says, those that come to me mourning and realizing, I can't live up to any of the system of the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. I don't even belong. I don't have what it takes to even I don't belong to you. I need you to receive me in, and I need you to teach me, and I need you to empower me to actually follow you and to be with you. So it says, they shall be comforted. So you notice the tense change, right? So verse 3 is, it's present tense. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then it's going to be shall, until you get to verse 10. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven again at the end. So it's the response that Jesus is offering is both right now, you're welcomed into the kingdom, but there's also part of it that's future. You shall experience this comfort. And then verse 5, the word meek is very similar to the word poor. So to be meek is to have abilities, but to be gentle and to not be aggressive, but to know it's to rely on God to accomplish things rather than you taking and grabbing things for yourself. The meek shall inherit the earth. And so what's interesting is, so this poor in spirit, those who are mourning, those who are meek, those come right out of the Old Testament. If you look at the first quote in the top of the bulletin, it's in two columns. So it says 61 is from Isaiah 61. The Spirit, speaking of how God's going to bring salvation in the future, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. And so that's God from the beginning has been saying, my salvation is going to bring good news and great things to the poor. I'm not going to bring good news to the middle class or to the wealthy. Right? Jesus says the wealthy don't need, the healthy don't need a surgeon, they don't need a physician, the sick do. And then verse 2, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, the day of vengeance for our God, to comfort all those who mourn. Right, same word Greek Old Testament. So he's pulling right out of that. And then in the second quote at the bottom of the first column, in just a little while the wicked shall be no more, though you look carefully at his place, he shall not be there, but the meek shall inherit the land. So Jesus is connecting back to the promises of the Old Testament of how salvation will come, and he's saying the entry into this discipleship relationship is realizing what you don't have. It's not at all coming forth and saying, look at everything I do have. So it's not trying to impress God at all, saying, you should take me in. But it's saying, God, I'm mourning because I realize how little I have. I have nothing. So he puts it in economic terms, I'm poor. He puts it in emotional terms, I'm mourning. I don't have even a contentment. He puts it in strength terms. I'm meek. So it shows us something very important. The Christian life can never be pretending that you've got it together, right? Or pretending that you understand what Jesus is about. Or, you know, fake it until you make it, right? Your first job out of college, kids, you probably will have to fake it until you make it, right? You'll probably have to be like, I know what's going on. Or even getting into college, right? They ask you to create a boast sheet, right? Alex and Quinlan produced one of some sort of like telling how great you are and how much the university should take you in because you're going to be such an asset to them. That it's the complete opposite here, right? You know, Jesus, you take me in. I should be one of your followers because I got some stuff to contribute. I'm going to make the whole campus life better. No, the way in is like, Lord, I got nothing. And if I try to pretend I have my life together, I'm disqualifying myself and I'm just casting myself out. So the Christian life following Jesus is not about pretending. It's not about fake it until you make it. It's not a I can do it. It's not externals only, because the Sermon on the Mount is going to speak to all of our internal situations as well. So the entry into discipleship with Jesus, the entry into understanding the Sermon on the Mount is, Lord, I have nothing. But you say, if I come to you and say I have nothing, that you take me in and you give me everything. You're going to give me to be part of the kingdom of heaven. So you give me identity. You give me belonging. I'm on campus. I'm mourning over how my sin shows up in big ways and in small ways. You say, coming to me in that way, there will be comfort. There will be some comfort now, and there'll be a complete comfort later. Like, I'm not going to insist I can be strong and I can grab a hold of what I need. If you come to me in that way, you'll inherit the earth. You'll inherit position and place. And so those three together show us how we come into relationship with Jesus. But I think they also show us how we continually stay in relationship with Jesus. Because he's speaking to disciples. Now, the disciples are a little bit clueless, a little bit into it. They're confused at times. But I think every follower of Jesus, we have to come back to, I'm poor. I'm mourning. I'm meek. So we enter that way, and there's times we screw up. And we come back to it, and we stay in following Jesus through those three. Because those three speak to what's really going on at the center of my heart and my mind and my conviction. And then, if you flip over your bulletin for a second, at the bottom half of the page, there's a graphic from Daniel Doriani's book on Matthew, who shows us an interesting idea. Beatitudes of need, poor in spirit, mourning, the meek. You take those attitudes of heart coming to Jesus, and they run through, so therefore, hunger and thirst for righteousness. Right? So you take those three and you bring them into this dynamic of Jesus, I realize I need righteousness. I need a whole lot of things. And Jesus says, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they shall be satisfied. They shall be filled to the brim. So what does Jesus mean by righteousness here? I think the best thing to see is it means four things. It's the comprehensive view of righteousness. It means being acquitted and declared not guilty before the courtroom judge, justification. But it also means I'm going to build in you actual righteousness. I'm going to enable you to live out my intentions in the Sermon on the Mount, sanctification. So in some ways, the Sermon on the Mount is like an empowered manifesto. Right? It's like, this is how you should live, but it's not just the game plan, it's you're empowered and strengthened to actually do it. So I've been spending a lot of time in Mavericks, the Apple operating system includes its own mapping program, right? So you don't have to go to Google Maps or MapQuest. And so I've been spending a lot of time in that, and so trying to plan some trips. It's almost, this empowered manifesto is almost like an empowered map, right? That you put in, oh, I want to go here and here. And then you're like, okay, it's going to take 3 hours. And all of a sudden, all these other buttons pop up, these bubbles, and say, you know what, you better watch out for this. That's going on there. This is going to happen here. You better do this. You better do this. And then it actually helps you to do it as you hit these areas of, oh, there's traffic here. You better do this. Oh, and there's the people that are in don't go to this garage if your car breaks down because they'll rip you off so you need to go here. It's as if all this extra stuff pops up out of the map, everything you actually need to live, and then Jesus walks you along with through those different things. Does that make sense? So it's not just you should do this, but it's come follow me and we will do it together. I will enable you to do it. I'll declare you not guilty and righteous to begin with so that we've got peace. So it's not based on, oh, you messed up, then. Because if he didn't give us righteousness as justification first, then we'd be like, oh, I screwed up. He doesn't love me now. I better do better so that he will love me. No, his covenant comes out, grabs hold and says, come, follow me. I love you. And now let me help you actually follow the map and the manifesto. And then, so that's the first two, righteousness. The third one is there is a social righteousness. There is a need for righteousness in this world. And in some ways, that's our tutoring program kicks back into that. Because there's a need for change in this world. So let's be Jesus' instruments of change. And then there's the last one is there's a final climactic righteousness. What Mike was talking about, all the earth will be set new at the resurrection of Jesus. There's an eschatological righteousness. Everything gets set right. Even the way that sin affected dirt gets changed, and dirt does exactly what it was meant to do in the first place. Much less we are built and we do exactly what we're made to do in the new heavens and the new earth the way he wanted us to. So four elements to this righteousness that he's calling us to. That makes sense? So that's the solution. The Sermon on the Mount is all about discipleship. It's about entering into relationship with Jesus and then about following him on this path of life that he has for us. And it's going to be rigorous, but he's given himself to us so fully that following him, realizing, confessing I have nothing, that I've screwed up, that I'm mourning over all my sin and my bad decisions and my arrogance. Jesus, I'm coming to you. I want to follow you. I want you to rebuild me. So then, how do we live this solution? So, we've seen Isaiah 61, he's speaking to it. But in one sense, in the second column, Isaiah 55 puts this blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness in a wonderful place. Right, let me just back up for 1 second. On righteousness, we have to make sure, the reason I put in verse 20 is we have to make sure that we are utterly convinced that we can't develop that level of the appropriate level of righteousness by ourselves. So what does Jesus say? For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. How righteous, how ethical were the scribes and Pharisees? How intent were they on doing the right thing? How scrupulous were they? Far more than any of us in the room. They were totally committed to, I'm going to be an ethical person. I'm going to make sure I don't break the law. I am so desirous to follow God and be right. But Jesus says, they don't have enough righteousness to make it. You have to have more righteousness than they have in order to make it. And if you don't have more than them, you're never going to enter the kingdom of heaven. But the irony is, if you come and say, Jesus, I am poor. I'm financially, morally, spiritually, disciplinedly poor. Then you say, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So Jesus grants us. Jesus gives us that. The only place we find that fullness of righteousness more than the scribes and Pharisees is from Jesus himself. So then Isaiah 55 puts it in this wonderful language of, come, everyone who thirsts. Right? Blessed are those who are hungry and thirsty. Come, everyone who thirsts. Come to the water. He who is poor, who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money, without price. And then it gets into our hearts a bit. Why do you look elsewhere? Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Starting to stick his nose into, well, I know you are buying bread from other people. Let's just sit down and think about how satisfying that bread is. How is it doing for you? You're going to the security shop for bread. How secure do you actually feel? You're spending your money at the power shop for bread, power bread. How powerful are you really? You're seeking approval and acceptance. You're trying to buy approval.